Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the Naked Englishman podcast. I'm Richard Vobes. It's 6:30 on the 26th. I think it's the 26th, a Sunday anyway. And the sun is shining, still no rain. We need rain for our pond. I hope you enjoyed the previous couple of audio recordings, podcasts, at the land with the sound effects of the land, the birds, the pheasants. You must have heard pheasants in there. They're always clucking, squawking and flapping, whatever it is that they do. And then the various bird song out there. And if you're a birder, no doubt you recognise some of the varieties of birds that we have in the British southern counties. I wonder how much they change as you go further north and into places like Wales or Scotland or even Ireland on these British Isles. It'd be interesting to know, really, if it changes throughout the year. This is something that's obviously new to us as we live... move closer to the land, I suppose, from the town. It felt quite oppressive coming back. I think I mentioned that yesterday. We are off again today for a couple of nights, I think, this week, and looking forward to it very much. Last night, Saturday, there was a lot of raucous stuff going on in the town. I went into the town to post a couple of my books, The Town That Wouldn't Comply, Biggleswick, and there was a strange atmosphere in the town. And then last night at the pub, there was huge amounts of noise and celebrations and singing, and but not normal singing, just sort of mad singing. I don't know what was going on, but there seemed to be something that was going on. I don't know. People were rejoicing about something, or there was tension about something. Maybe it was just Saturday night and people letting their hairs down, I don't know. Anyway, not watching the news. I have no idea what goes on in the world, and that's such a benefit, really, to be sold the nonsense in the narrative is not for me. Also, I wondered if you enjoyed that book that was sent to me, I can't remember what it was, A Marvellous Revolution or something. That was a nice little book. Yes, I've got to feature it on the show, so I'm taking the camera. I must find it over the next couple of days and find the book. I put it down somewhere to read. Still reading some of R.F. Delderfield's work. Haven't read as much as I would like to recently, unfortunately, because we've been pretty busy, although we have been reading one of his books, Farewell to a Tranquil Mind, to each other. And that's been very nice. I've been sent so many books over the recent months. There is a feeling that I need to downsize a bit because I'm getting too many of them. And I really want to get... probably won't read them a second time. I can't see the need to keep them. So I'm probably likely to pass them on if anybody's interested. Of course, I really need to make a pile of them or a list of them and then and let people know what I've got to, you know, in case people were interested. I think I've got a couple of those Dr. Fauci books. The one I found, I think, and then somebody gave me the other one, the True Nature of Dr. Fauci. He is the sort of your Dr. Mengele of the modern time, in a way. He is a really nasty, nasty piece of work, quite aware that the vaccine was full of snake venom and various other venoms, and that he was going to assist in the depopulation by allowing people to be injected. He's been on the scene doing this sort of evil work And you do think, I don't know whether you agree with this, but you do think that when people do such evil, that they ought to get their comeuppance somewhere along the line. But it doesn't seem to work that way, does it? If it did, I guess people wouldn't be evil. People say crime doesn't pay. And we hear, of course, many criminals get caught and put in prison. Or in the past, they've been dispatched in one way or another. But not all of them. And there must be a high enough percentage for people to think that it is worth the crime. And by crime, I mean, you know, real crime. Not the civil matters that you hear about, where people are refusing to pay civil bills, which shouldn't even exist. I'm talking about people who get who go around murdering people, or stealing from people, or really causing another person great harm. Anyway, I'm sure I've talked about this book before, but it just caught my eye this morning as we are on going to our little farm, our little land, piece of God's earth, however you wish to talk about it. And this is a book that I've had for some time, and actually it's been a great help in writing my other book that I'm still trying to get time to write. And it sounds awful, doesn't it? I do enjoy the writing process. I don't enjoy the editing process. I don't know who does. I like the creative part. This is the one during the war, in which it's an elderly lady writing of her childhood experiences and comparing the world of yesterday with the world of today. And leaving, I suppose, that conclusion up to the reader. That's really what it is. And this book that I picked off the shelf just now is called Heartbreak Farm, A Farmer and His Farm in Wartime. It's a beautifully put together book. I got it for 99p. And it's by Frances Mountford. And she did all the watercolours in it. I'm sure I've talked about it before. I'm going to read to you the inside flap of the dust cover. It says, Ray, that's Raybald, was born at Egg Hill Farm, beg your pardon, 13 days before the turn of the century, and grew up on a 100-acre arable farm, from which, on a clear day, 7 counties could be seen. Ray, the boy, worked with horses for his father and also helped out on his uncle's farm. As a young man, he continued to work for his father, but after he married, he left to start up on his own farm in Staffordshire. Soon his crops were flourishing, and he had built up a small milk round. At the beginning of 1939, he moved away to Camp Farm near Lichfield. For a while, all went well, but then war was declared. Farmers had to dig for victory, and it soon became clear that Raybould's and the farming families across the country that demands made by the Ministry of Agriculture were sometimes unrealistic and unreasonable. The unpopular War Ag Committee, the men from there, had absolute power to evict farmers who had no right for appeal. For the Raybould's, it was to be a time of heartbreak. In this new book from the author of A Commoner's Cottage, Frances Mountford recreates the words and in pen and ink drawings, and detailed colourings, the changing life of a farmer in the first half of this century, with horse ploughing, haymaking, riding to hounds and shire horses, which were indispensable for carrying out the work. including visits from itinerant labourers and the hardships and pleasures of rural life, and then goes on to describe how a life that had been envisaged of going on forever came to an abrupt end. 50 years on, the pain and injustice of the war years is still keenly felt, and this book describes how the farmers tried to fight back. Because this was published, when was this published? In the '80s, I imagine. Let's have a look. Oh, 1997, so very close. And it's a beautifully illustrated book. And it tells the story of some of that. Excuse me. And I just find... I find it very inspiring, really, even though it's a, you know, great throwback to the old days. So I thought, just for a bit more fun, I would read a little piece here from chapter 8. Because in many ways, I think, although this is about the wartime and people had to pull together and the war wanted, had this idea, this notion that we all should obey what was a decision made by a few men in smoke-filled rooms to declare war on Hitler, and then the results of all of that, whether that was the right decision or not, I'm not going to make a point on. But it's the notion, really, that men and women are never free, that self-appointed people, it would seem, under a guise of democracy, have bullied people from the start and made out that they are in control and their decisions matter. That went on then, and it's going on now, and nothing has changed. So let me read you this bit. This is the men from the ministry on a farm in 1940. The war that changed everyone's lives, and farmers were no exception. From the end of the previous war until the beginning of this one, they had struggled through the Depression, eking out a living as best they could, with the government making very little interest in their activities. Everywhere the farms were run down through lack of money, and building, drains and fences in need of repair all over the country. Our lives, too, were soon taken to a different course, and it was to be the 30 acres of marshy bog field that would ultimately be the reason for this change. The field was old pasture. The grass was short and sweet, mixed with herbs of all sorts, and of such variety that it must have taken a great many years for them to become established. Lapwings soared over the field, and skylarks hovered above it on tremolo wings. The clear, purling stream that ran beneath the alder trees for the length of the field rippled over smooth brown pebbles, between which grew great bunches of emerald weed that flowed and waved in the current like the green hair of a water nymph. At the edges were lush mats of watercress, brook lime and kingcups. There was always horses or cattle grazing in the field, and near the gate Ray set up a pink lump of iodized rock salt, and their tongues sculpted it into smooth concavities. It seemed that the bog field could never alter. The war forced the government to take drastic steps to improve the state of the land, because at that time 70% of the food for the people was imported. The war meant that few imports would be arriving, and Britain must grow its own food in order to prevent the population from starving. All farmers, smallholders and market gardeners, suddenly found themselves under scrutiny. As early as 1936, the government had been making plans in case there should be a war, And despite objections from some ministers that the policy of intervention was not the right one and that other methods could be found to induce farmers to grow more food, the government decided to set up the county agricultural committees, similar to those of the First World War, whose task it was to coerce the farmers into greater production. Men from each county were selected by the government to act as the chief executives of these committees. The executives were free to nominate their own committees. Unfortunately, this created opportunities for favouritism and nepotism, for no one on the committees was elected democratically by a body of people. At first, little consideration was given to these aspects, but as time went on, they occasionally became apparent. J. Wentworth Day, a Cambridgeshire writer on country matters, included a blistering 19-page chapter entitled Little Hitlers on the Farm in his book Harvest Adventure. He was concerned at the manner in which the committees had been formed in 1939, in a way which he considered very un-English, with the men on them to be able to flaunt authority, use petrol, and order their neighbours about. As the county chairman and chief executives were free to choose their friends and acquaintances to sit on their committees, they were obviously not democratically chosen, but most importantly, they were empowered to exercise Defence Regulation 62 whenever they wished. This regulation gave these committees the right to take possession of any land together with buildings on that land, but owners and tenants who protested had no recourse to normal lawful judgment. The time-honoured ancient words of the Magna Carta, the cornerstone of English liberty, were now disregarded, and a landowner had no longer the right to be tried in an open court or to appeal if he were ordered out to quit by these men. Like all farmers, Ray was aware that with the coming of war conditions, things would change. For a start, there was the rationing of artificial fertilisers, animal foodstuffs and petrol, to say nothing of the rationing of food and clothing for the human population. Bid received extra sugar at jam-making time, but that's the name of the Bid, is the name of the wife. I forget what her name is, but they call her Bid. Bid received extra sugar at jam-making time, but she still hoarded some, if she could, from the usual ration. Unlike townspeople, we had our own milk, eggs and vegetables. But sometimes the older foodstuffs were difficult to come by. As Bid had always been very thrifty, clothes were not a present problem, as they were for some people. We didn't need to look smart, and my clothes, the writer says, was passed down from me from an older cousin in town. Old woollen jumpers were unravelled, and the wool The wool that was good was knitted up again to make something else. Everything was darned and darned again, and nothing was thrown away until it was absolutely threadbare. Even then, the rags were used for dusters and polishing cloths. Bid was occasionally left with clothes coupons that she could sell. It goes on, and I'm just aware of time on this. I'll give you a little bit more. Because the war ag people were quite vicious and evicted farmers from their land, as it says, with no recourse. I feel the government is doing a similar thing, but a bit more subtly, because people have social media and they're a bit wiser these days. But I think they're doing the same. They're getting rid of farmers one way or another, making it too expensive. They're doing it through the pocket or the wallet, I suppose. At first, Ray didn't think very much about how farming itself might change or about the committee men and how they might be selected. Then The men from the War Agricultural Committee began to visit the farms all over the country and issue orders. Everyone called them the War Ag. The farmers knew that more food had to be produced and that they must cooperate, but sometimes they felt it was very difficult for them to do so. There were cases of dairy farmers being instructed to sell all herds that had taken them years to build up and plant their fields with corn or potatoes, while arable farmers, who knew very well that crops would grow best on their land, were irritated when they were ordered by a stranger who made only a brief visit to tell them to grow something that they considered to be unsuitable. Another writer, George Henderson, I've got his book, who ran an Oxfordshire farm in an extremely efficient manner, wrote in The Farming Ladder, I've got a copy of that somewhere on my shelf, his annoyance at orders compelling him to carry out cultivations with which he, knowing his farm so much better than an outsider, could not always agree. He said, "While no one can doubt that the vast majority of decisions are made honestly and fairly, it is a negation of British justice that there is no appeal." He felt that the practices of forming decisions from a casual inspection of farms is unfair. And you've got to remember, of course, farmers knew their land. They knew what would grow. They knew the aspect with the sun. They knew the general participation of rain. They knew what the winds were like and where things would grow best and what sort of crops, depending on the pH of the soil and all these things. And these other strangers coming in saying, no, we need more potatoes. Get rid of your herd of cows. When obviously milk was a very important part of somebody's diet. It is just, you know, it was open for abuse, as you could see. Eventually, a Warwickshire War Ag man came on to Camp Farm and instructed Ray to plough up two grass fields and to plant them with corn. Ray pointed out the field, called Australia, was very poor and covered with stones and could not produce a good crop. They agreed that this year it would be better to plough near Middlefield instead, although it was a smaller field than Australia. Over at Egg Hill Farm, Grandpa and the uncles received specific orders for cultivation of 56 of their acres, while back at Enville, 70 acres of the sheep walks were to be ploughed and reseeded at the cost to the estate of between £600 and £700. Enville Hall itself was eventually occupied by American troops. Many farmers disputed their cultivation orders. Mr. Pickering in Rugby area told the Warwickshire War Ag that he was not in a financial position to plough fields as he had been instructed. He suggested that the committee took them over at a fair rent for the duration of the war. His offer was declined, and he was informed that there was credit facilities available for this, for causes of this kind. At their regular weekly meetings, the War Ag committees discussed all manner of subjects relating to their efforts to increase the acreage under the plough and the production of food. They noted the letters received from disconsolate recipients of ploughing and cultivation orders, and they frequently displayed their utter indifference to any that pleaded hardship. And in January 1941, the Vicar of Eckington sent a letter to the Worcestershire War Ag stating that Mr. Griffiths on Court End Farm, Eckington, was dying, and he asked whether the committee could see its way to postponing the operation of the cultivation order which had been served on Mr. Griffiths. The meeting resolved that in its present decision, resolved that its previous decision be adhered to. So they were, you know, quite mean and quite vicious. Anyway, it does go on, but it's, you know, I think it's absolutely fascinating. I thought I'd share some of that in today's episode. And as you can see, that sort of thing, in my book that I want to write, wants to reflect on what I suppose what I've been saying, an example of that, how things don't really change, you know, authority still buggers people up, and it's under a guise of doing the right thing or for our benefit. It's all for your benefit. Go and take this jab with snake venom in it. Is snake venom really the best thing? Oh, sorry, I didn't mean to tell you it had snake venom in it. I meant to lie and said it was very good for you, even though it's been made at the speed of science, and all other vaccines take a lot longer and we test them. And actually, there's some stuff already available on the shelf that we won't recommend because there's no money in it. But we'll work adequately and perfectly. And actually, the whole bloody virus is a made-up thing to begin with. So it's all about us making a lot of money and keeping you under our thumb. Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? Anyway, thank you for listening. And I may do more recordings on the land and put them up later on. But I better go and have a cup. Well, I've had a cup of coffee. Get this uploaded, I suppose. Until next time, bye for now.